Ladies and gentlemen, the last speaker of the day for the annual lecture, we are very lucky to have Jerry Roberts here with us. Now, I first met Jerry not long after I met up formally with Bletchley Park. That day I was filming with my son, and I thought I knew so much about the place, and I realised I didn't really know much at all. As a result of that, I went to meet one or two people, and we filmed them with a company that I was working with for a documentary. The second person that I filmed after Mavis Beatty was Jerry. And what a surprise. Bright as a button, doesn't miss a trick, with a razor-sharp memory. And then when I wanted to find out what he actually did, he wasn't so interested in telling me what he did. He was more interested in telling me what the others did around him, like Bill Tutt and Tiltman and Tommy Flowers, and he kept telling me they're the heroes. I just, you know, plodded away. Well, thank God he was plodding away. He worked in a special section that was set up under the leadership of Captain Ralph Tester, and it was known as the Testery, as we've heard. At its height, remember that Bletchley had 10,000 people working here. At its height, the Testery had 9. Jerry Roberts, a young 20-year-old at the time, was one of those 9 people. Now, that tells you, if only 9 in that section, they probably were quite different people and quite gifted people, as Jerry not only was, but still is. Luckily, he's still got all his marbles, as he will demonstrate in a few minutes. Now, these extraordinary individuals worked round the clock to access the inner secrets of the German High Command with what has been described as the outstanding mental feat of the 20th century, because all of this work was not done with a computer. It was done with a pencil and some paper. And that's what makes it truly unusual. The Colossus came in to speed the process up because some of the information they realized were the Tunney code was so important that it had to be got out to the troops, the generals commanding, so fast, or as fast as you could. And Kursk was a great example of that. And so when we did some filming here with Jerry, and we got him down to the basement where the bomb is, and at the end there is a big Lorenz machine there, encased in glass, and we needed GCHQ's permission to actually get the Lorenz machine out of the glass. I sat him next to it and I was quietly firing away questions. Jerry, tell me about this and tell me about that and explain this to us. And halfway through between questions, he muttered to himself something. I said, what did you just say? And he said, it's funny that. I've never actually seen this machine before. I said, Jerry, this is 2011, for God's sake. Why do you leave it until you're 90 to say you haven't seen them? Weren't you curious? And he said, no, not really. It was just the breaking of the code was the challenge. Damn, I would have wanted to take the thing apart to actually see every bit of that machine. But that was Jerry for you. And Jerry is, I think, the only person now left alive in the world who intercepted Hitler's messages direct from him. And it's a strange thing, because exactly 5 days ago, I was standing in Hitler's nest. You heard of Hitler's nest in Bavaria. It was built at the cost of £35 million in those days by the chairman of the Nazi party as a birthday present for Hitler. But it was where he entertained, as a private place just for him, an amazing engineering feat. But of course, when there was only one way he talked to his generals, like Kesselring and other generals, and that was with Tunney, through people like Jerry, who hopefully was listening and passing on this incredibly valuable information. Before I hand over to Jerry, his last remark was, when I talked to him, and I wrote an article about him not long ago for a magazine, was he proud of the part that he played? And he said, not really. He said, the real heroes, which is typical Jerry, who were quite exceptional, were Alan Turing, Tommy Flowers, and Bill Tutt. Jerry, over to you.
Charles, well done as ever. That's going to take a bit of living up to. The first time I came to Bletchley Park was in 1941, autumn. And at that time, we were not allowed even to come into the house at the beginning. It was off limits. And it's splendid to see it peopled so well now, but it was very different then. I was asked to talk about Tunney and the breaking of Tunney, but I would like to spend just 5 minutes talking about Turing, because quite honestly, from one point of view, if it hadn't been for Turing, we wouldn't be sitting here. I'm personally eternally grateful to him that I didn't have to bring up my children under a Nazi regime. The reason for that is in the tonnages. The average for the 4 months, March to July 1941, was 282,000 tons of shipping lost. 282,000. Turing broke Naval Enigma in July, August 41. By November, those tonnages had dropped to 64,000, a drop of 77%. If he hadn't managed that, it is almost certain that Britain would have been starved out of the war and defeated, and we would have entered a dark age, a Nazi dark age, of what, 30 years, 50 years? Once the Nazis had got you down, they didn't let you up. And I had glimpses of this when I met the friend of a neighbour a few months ago. He had been in the SAS during the war, a tough unit, and he made a crossing of the Atlantic in early 41, and he told me about it. When he did, his face darkened. "The worst days of my life," he said. "We left port with 23 ships and we arrived in Britain with 11. U-boats had downed 12 ships with all their and left the crews struggling in the water or on lifeboats. And I had a further taste of it after the war, because after the war I met a wonderful, brave Belgian lady called Madame Gentil. And she had been one of those families who kept a safe house for Allied airmen shot down over Europe and trying to make their way back to Britain to fly again. And Helene Gentil and her husband had a hidey hole in their house. And they had an airman in there one day when the Gestapo came calling. Their usual time, of course, 6 a.m., they searched the house up and down, but didn't find him. Went away, everybody delighted and relieved, claps on the back, whatever the Belgians do, and the Gestapo came back. She pretended to be Dulally to try and get him off, but her husband was arrested, taken away, and she never saw him again. And that sort of thing would have happened time and time and time again in this country if the Nazis had won. I used to see Turing from time to time, and I have a strong mental image of him walking along the corridor in one of the huts with his gaze turned downwards. He was a shy and diffident man, flicking the walls with his fingers, dressed in a mid-dark brown sports jacket and baggy grey trousers. This is not your Achilles figure. He was not a warrior king, but at that juncture, he was the most influential man in Europe, bar none. In a way, bar Churchill. And we owe this to Turing. So let's turn to Tunney. Charles has given us some indications, but let me firm them up. In 1940, Hitler's mind was obviously turning to his plans to dominate Europe. He realized he would have land wars and that his army was going to be pretty busy, and his generals. And up to that point, the Army, Navy and Air Force had used the normal system for enciphering at that time. But Hitler wasn't satisfied with that and felt communications between his generals at headquarters and the generals in charge of the huge forces on the different battlefronts were going to need something more powerful, something more secure. And so he went to the Siemens company, big German electrical outfit, and they gave him a superb machine, the Lorenz SZ-4042. That's Sonderzusatz, which means special attachment. And the special attachment was the bit that enciphered. If you and I had to encipher a message, we'd probably use a letter substitution or something like that. And that would give us one level of encryption. Tunney had not one, not two, but three levels of encryption. Even two is a cryptologist's nightmare. Three is out of this world. So why was it so important? A number of reasons. First of all, the people who signed the messages and whose names we used to see cropping up time and again in the messages we broke. Keitel, who was the head of the army, the whole army. Von Jodl, who was the chief of staff of the whole army, the chief operating officer. That's not a bad start. And his number two, Barlaimont. So those were the people at one end. The people at the other end included the generals and field marshals in charge of the fighting forces on each of the battlefronts. And we covered five main battlefronts, the important ones. People like von Rundstedt, von Weichs, von Kluger, Model. These are the people, for instance, who headed up the three Russian sectors. The links also give us a clue. The ones that we covered were the three Russian Eastern Fronts, North, Central and South. Then there was another link in the West, and finally one in the Italian peninsula, because when the Germans were routed out of North Africa, they moved their troops to Sicily, and then when they were routed out from there, they moved them to the Italian peninsula, and we had to push them back. They made a very stubborn defense, but General Kesselring, who was commanding, was eventually pushed right back, and that danger was liquidated. Army Enigma at that stage dealt with divisions and regiments. Tunney dealt with armies and army groups, Heeresgruppen. It produced very high-grade intelligence all the time, as you can imagine. But there were four major situations in which Tunney played a major part. Before D-Day, for instance, it was important to know whether the Germans were going to keep the bulk of their troops in the Calais-Boulogne region, as Hitler wanted, or in Normandy, as the generals wanted. The generals were the professionals. They knew that we needed landing beaches. But Hitler was the boss. The British did so many creative things during the war, clever tricks. One of the clever tricks was to moor along the Kent and Essex coasts a series of things which from the air looked like landing craft, a large number of these. And Hitler fell for it and thought, well, they're going to attack the Calais-Boulogne region. Amazing, but it worked. Through Tunney decrypts, we knew that Hitler had prevailed and that Normandy, as a result, would be more lightly defended than if the generals had had their way. And this gave encouragement for the landing. We have to remember that if D-Day had failed, if, in fact, Hitler had moved all those troops down to Normandy, the odds were that the D-Day landings would have failed, and it would have taken at least 2 years to mount another similar effort. And in that time, of course, Hitler could well have made Europe impregnable. Not only that, but his scientists were working on their own atom bomb and had brought together 25% of the chemical needed to arm that bomb. It was a very crucial time. The second situation was Kursk. The Germans had made an enormous effort to get at the Russian petrol fields at Stalingrad, and as you know, they failed in December 42, January 43. But in April of that year, they planned another assault, a huge assault at the city of Kursk. And we broke Tunney decrypts, which showed this was the plan. Eventually, the battle took place on the 5th of July of that year. So we gave the Russians at least 3 months' warning, and they used that 3 months. They even put pressure on their tank factories to turn out more product, because we'd warned the Russians that the Germans were going to put emphasis on tanks. And of course, it turned out to be the biggest tank battle ever. A huge number of tanks on each side. The third case was after D-Day. After D-Day, there was a period of stalemate where the battle lines got bogged down. We failed to take Caen in Normandy, and the Germans were holding out. And von Kluger, who was in charge of the German forces in the body of France, was tasked by Hitler with pushing the Allies back into the sea, or at least holding the line. And he managed to do that for 3 or 4 weeks. And then Patton broke through in the west of France, and Bernard Montgomery broke through in the north, and they managed to surround a fair portion of the German forces and took 90,000 prisoners. Von Kluger was ordered back to Berlin by Hitler to give an account of himself, but he committed suicide rather than face a furious Hitler. And the fourth special case was Italy, where we managed eventually to push the Germans steadily northwards until they were out of the way. And we broke a large number of messages to and from von Kluger, and in the Italian peninsula, a large number to and from Kesselring. Eisenhower, after the war, said, "Bletchley decrypts shorten the war by at least 2 years." Now, this was a war in which, on average, 10 million people had died each year. 10 million. If Hitler had been given another 2 years, anything could have happened. The Russians could have encroached a lot further and been much more difficult to dislodge. And Hitler with an atom bomb doesn't bear thinking about. So how did Tunney work? Tunney had 3 levels of encryption. It used the BODOT alphabet, which for each letter of the alphabet converted that letter into 5 impulses, negative or positive. For instance, the letter E was positive and then 4 negatives. The letter T was four negatives and then a positive. Each letter had a different shape, and there were six symbols as well that were used. For instance, plus plus to indicate I'm going into punctuation, and 8-8 to say I'm coming out of punctuation, going to ordinary text. And the number 9, the figure 9, as the spacer between words. So Tunney had the three sets of wheels. It had the five Chi wheels, and they moved in every position. They would encipher a letter, say, A would become G. That G would be enciphered again by the five Psi wheels. And whether the Psi wheels moved or not was controlled by the two motor wheels. So the next time it came round, the motor wheels would have decided to do something quite different. And there you get your three levels of encryption. It should never, ever have been broken. So how was it broken? We owe the fact that we knew all these inner workings of the top generals' minds to two people, to Hitler, who conveniently packaged them all into the Tunney system, and we must be grateful to him for that, and a Tunney operator who sent a message from Athens, 4,000 characters long, to his colleague in Vienna. And his colleague had a lot of corruption and wasn't satisfied with the condition of the message, bits missing, so he told him to send it again. And the operator did. He sent it again. And he made two catastrophic errors. Catastrophic errors. When you consider all the consequences they had, I feel we ought to put up a statue to him in Whitehall. First, he didn't change the settings. So he sent the second time round on the same settings as the first time. And that gives what cryptologists call a depth. Two messages encrypted exactly the same way. And they love working with that. That's the first step of entry into a system. The second mistake he made was even worse, because he changed the text of the message in places. Basically, it was the same text, but for instance, he would write NUMA as NR, the abbreviation, and that made a shift of four letters, four places in the text. Well, these messages were received and picked up, and the job was passed to Colonel Tiltman, the most experienced cryptographer in the British Army and quite possibly on the British side. He worked on it for 10 days, and he broke the two messages, and he worked out that it was on the Bodot system and how that system worked. That was a big step forward, but he couldn't break the system. Hardly surprising.